This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. From March to December last year, about 57,000 eviction notices were filed in Florida, and that number is likely an undercount. It's just one of the startling statistics and reporting from the Orlando Sentinel in a series called Locked Out. It's about the eviction crisis as the pandemic amplified an already perilous housing situation for thousands of residents. For more about the housing crisis and the long-term implications, I spoke to the Sentinel's Caroline Glenn and Desiree Stennett. Well, Caroline Glenn is a business reporter covering workers, housing and economic injustice. Caroline, it's nice to see you again and thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Desiree Stennett is a senior reporter at the Orlando Sentinel. She writes about race and inequality in Florida. Thank you as well.
Of course, I'm happy to be here.
So Caroline, I want to start with you. In the first part of the series, you report on the situation of one family who lost their jobs due to the pandemic and then lost their home. What stood out for you in the reporting on this story?
So for this particular family, the Bennett family, the reason they stuck out to me is because they were evicted before any of these eviction moratoriums were put into place or before the federal government had provided the money to prop up these rental assistance programs that cities and counties now have. So they are an example of how fast-paced and harsh eviction can be. The mom in this situation, she was a nursing assistant and the dad had been between jobs finding work at a temp agency. And as soon as the mom lost her job in March, they quickly fell behind on the rent and their landlord told them to leave. It wasn't a court process. They didn't have a hearing. They didn't tell the judge their side of the story. You know, financial hardship is not usually a defense in the case of eviction. The moratorium gave people a way to get in front of a judge, but the Bennetts are illustrative of how this process normally plays out. And they today are living in one of those pay-by-the-week hotels where they pay $400 a week. They live in one room. Mom and dad sleep in one bed, and their five kids, who are all under the age of six, sleep in another. And that's really what the fallout from eviction can look like in the state of Florida.
Desiree, I'd like to bring you into this conversation now. Your part of the series drops today. What did you find in your reporting?
In the simplest terms, what we found was that in zip codes with the largest Black populations across Central Florida, we tended to see the highest eviction rates as well. And that is something that was the case before the pandemic hit. And during the pandemic, even as Caroline was saying that the moratoriums and the rental assistance programs were put into place, we saw that in majority Black areas, the eviction rates held, that they were higher when there are more Black residents living in a particular area.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that Caroline pointed out in her reporting. There's a kind of a health and safety aspect of this too, right? I mean, people who are evicted, you know, if you don't have a home in a situation where, at least as it was in 2020, where people were being told essentially shelter in place, that's a pretty big kind of chasm in terms of how do you protect your family from a pandemic, right?
Absolutely. One expert we spoke to talked about how just getting an eviction notice on your door, even if you're never actually evicted, can lead to worse health outcomes, both physically and mentally for families. And in this particular situation, I think in the past year, we've had a lot of conversations about health equity, and we've seen nationwide that Black residents, Black Americans, were more likely to die from COVID-19 than their white counterparts. And I think that that, paired with the fact that Black residents were more likely to be evicted, really creates a scary situation where we know that those most vulnerable to poor health outcomes are being thrown into situations where they may be doubling up with family, if they're lucky, after an eviction, which can increase the number of people in a household and therefore can increase the likelihood of someone getting COVID-19 in the household and spreading it throughout. And the same for in even worse situations where if you don't have family to stay with, you could end up in a homeless shelter with, I mean, hundreds of strangers, and your likelihood of getting COVID-19 spikes even higher. And this is among a community that is, like I said, more likely to die of the symptoms.
When you follow people and follow their stories for that long, I mean, a story you tell about them one month can be profoundly different the next month, right? Have there been some positives out of that, or has it been sort of a downward slide? Because some of the stories are pretty grim.
Well, for one of my tenants, that woman, Alexis Green, the mom of two from Claremont, her story changed while we were reporting. When I first met her, she had had an eviction filed against her in court, but she had filed the CDC moratorium, and so her case was halted. That was back in September last year. But then her landlord asked for another hearing because he wanted to challenge the CDC moratorium. I sat with her during her court hearing, which was held over Zoom. And although I'm not an attorney or a legal expert, I walked away from it thinking I thought she had a pretty solid case. And I thought that the judge would rule in her favor and she'd be able to continue to stay. About a week later, Alexis called me on the phone in tears in her bathroom so that her kids wouldn't hear she had gotten the bad news that the judge ruled against her. And we did not expect that to happen. So reporting on these stories can be very difficult because, like you said, things are changing in an instant. This is a very fast-paced process sometimes. And someone who we thought was in a stable situation then became homeless. Alexis is now living with a friend. Her two kids are living with their dad. I went back to her house and hung out with her while she literally packed up her entire house, you know, putting all of their belongings, all of their memories into trash bags, loading them into a moving truck to be put into storage. So there were some aspects of the story that literally changed while we were doing the reporting.
What did you find, Desiree?
I think I would agree with Caroline here. And I think what's important to take away from this is that when we heard that there was going to be a moratorium on evictions, I think the takeaway from that is no one is getting evicted. And I think what we found during this project is that's just false. Of the four families that we featured in this story, only one of them is still in her home. And she is at a place where she is attempting to prepare for what will happen if she is evicted. And her name is Bathsheba Collingwood. She lives in along Mercy Drive in one of the zip codes that are featured in my story as one of the zip codes with the highest Black populations in the region. And she has watched literally dozens of her neighbors be evicted since she moved into her apartment last May. And she, when I met her, she had already been filed. Her landlord had already filed one eviction against her, and a judge had already decided that she should stay because she was to be protected by the CDC order. However, when I met her, it was just weeks after the county had paid the landlord $4,000 to help catch her up on back rent. And a part of that agreement through the rental assistance program through Orange County was that residents were not supposed to get filed against them again for at least 60 days. And less than a month later, she was facing eviction again. And the anxiety, I think, that she felt was just almost physical. Like, I could almost feel it because she had had one eviction on her record before, and the judge that she was to go before to present the CDC order again was the same judge who evicted her in 2019. And she was terrified that although she had just sort of run into hard times like everyone else during this pandemic, she was afraid that the judge would remember her name and would remember her face and think she was just routinely delinquent on rent and would kick her out just because of that. She was lucky enough to be able to stay, but at this point she is making plans for the unfortunate possibility that could be that she will have to live in her car if she is forced out of her apartment right now. And I think of the four families, if she is forced to live in her car or into a homeless shelter, she will be one of three that for at least a period was homeless after being evicted.
Caroline, I come back to that stat as well, the 57,000 evictions, despite the moratorium. I mean, it's a kind of a staggering figure. And I'm wondering, in the course of your reporting, does it seem like that is because is the legal system not working properly or the way it should to protect people, or are there just too many loopholes in the moratorium to allow landlords to keep filing these eviction notices? Like, what do you think is going on?
There's a couple of things that factor into why so many evictions were filed during the pandemic. First of all, the moratorium is not actually just a blanket moratorium. And I think that name alone confuses people. They think that there's a moratorium, landlords can't evict anyone. Some people, tenants, don't even know the moratorium exists. So there is a lack of awareness and a lack of getting the information out. I mean, getting the information out about tenants' rights and the CDC moratorium, the state moratorium that existed before DeSantis let it expire, that really fell to nonprofits, to the legal aid community, and to journalists. There wasn't a huge push from the state itself to let people know about their rights. That being said, too, there are some very specific requirements to fall under the CDC moratorium. It's not just enough to say, I'm a renter, I can't be evicted. You have to have a COVID-19 hardship. You need to be able to attest that you would become homeless and that you've exhausted every effort to find some government assistance to get caught up on your rent. That being said, there are many people who fit that bill that were still not spared. The other thing that I really wanted to emphasize with this project was the unequal protections for homeowners versus renters. So if you are a renter and you fall behind on, you know, your renter payments, you miss it 1 month, you can immediately now have an eviction filed against you and you could become homeless in a matter of weeks. Whereas homeowners just have more protections. The foreclosure process is much lengthier. By federal law, lenders cannot even file the first legal notice against a delinquent homeowner for their mortgage until 4 months after the first missed payment. I talked with Chief Judge Donald Myers over the Orange and Osceola courthouses, and he said that even in our system, we recognize that the foreclosure process is really probably going to take upwards of a year. You are not going to become homeless in a matter of weeks. And that's why we wanted to focus on tenants, that they were so much more exposed. Even if you just look at the difference in the median income between renters and homeowners, homeowners as a whole were on much more solid financial footing before the pandemic began. The median income for a homeowner in Florida is about $70,000, whereas for a renter, it's about $42,000. And so many renters, I mean, literally 1.4 million of Florida's 2.7 million renter households spend more than 30% of their yearly income on rent. That is a huge chunk of money that you're paying on your housing. And when you suddenly get laid off from your job and you have no income, that lack of wages has eroded the ability to have savings for a situation like this. But I mean, if you have no income for a year, how are you really going to catch up on that rent unless these cities and counties make rental assistance programs as accessible as possible?
If you're just joining me, my guests are Orlando Sentinel reporters Desiree Stennett and Caroline Glenn. We're talking about their series Locked Out, which is about evictions during the pandemic. Desiree, you've been covering race and inequality for some time now. If you kind of take a step back and look at some of the responses that we're seeing to the disparities that the pandemic has essentially widened, are we seeing enough of a response from either local and state governments or the federal government or other agencies? And how do you see this kind of playing out from here?
Well, I think that a lot of the approach to housing and evictions and sort of closing that gap there, at least from my viewpoint, seems to be viewed holistically. It seems to be viewed in the terms of let's help all of Orange County or let's help low-income residents get affordable housing. Like Caroline said, Florida is one of the states with the largest affordable housing problems in the country, and we, like many other cities and states, don't have enough stock for the needs of our community. What I'm finding is that a lot of the conversation is not specifically focused on race, if I'm to be honest. But I think that in many instances, when you focus on low-income communities, because unemployment is higher in Black communities and Black residents are overrepresented in lower-paying jobs, sometimes when you focus on low-income, you are able to sort of capture the groups that need help the most. For example, when the county organized its rental assistance program, we did find when we looked at the data that those who got the most assistance through the program did live in the zip codes with the highest Black populations. So it's not that there's nothing happening to sort of close that racial inequality, that gap, but it is sort of focused more through the lens of income disparity versus racial inequality. But what I also talked to experts that looked at this through a racial lens, what they were also saying was that we have to, going forward, start to create housing policy that specifically looks at this through the lens of race, because we got into the situation with policy that specifically looked at housing through the lens of race. And I mentioned redlining in passing earlier, but in case people are not entirely familiar with what I'm referring to there, it was once legal U.S. policy to discriminate in housing and to decide the value of a home or who would get a loan based solely on race. And the presence of Black people in a neighborhood automatically lowered the housing value. And it's being Black, even if you were financially able to take on a mortgage, it was legal based on U.S. law to deny you that mortgage, as particularly in particular neighborhoods that were white. So I think that there are a lot of experts who look at this through an equity lens, who see this as a problem that cannot be solved unless we look at the solutions through a racial lens as well.
Caroline, it seems like there's a lot more reporting to be done, and you're obviously going to be, both of you are going to be following this story pretty closely. And it's not just as simple as saying, you know, when the economy picks back up again and people get their jobs back, their housing situations will resolve, right? I mean, it seems like this has got a pretty long tail on it.
Absolutely. Eviction can change the course of your entire life. And there are children wrapped up in this as well, who this will change the trajectory of their lives. And so far, we have not seen much interest from state legislative leaders to take a comprehensive approach at solving some of these issues. And they all roll together. You know, the conversation around eviction is also a conversation around, like Desiree pointed out, race equality. It's a conversation around wages, public transit, access to education. It's a conversation around safe living conditions. It's so many things. And that's been a conversation that's been going on in Central Florida for many, many years. It didn't make it into this story, but I talked with a couple of the labor unions that represent hospitality workers, and they told me this is the same story, but just in the worst possible circumstances. We know in Central Florida about these wage gaps. We know that they exist for women. We know that they exist for people of color. And what I wanted to emphasize is that these were the people who were living paycheck to paycheck even before the pandemic started. And then once it hit, there just was nothing really to save them. And we'll get into this much more in the third part of this series, but there is not the same concerted effort to lobby for tenants as there is to lobby for landlords. In the state of Florida, the landlord lobby is very influential and very powerful. And that is the thing that tenant advocates point to as the reason why more protections for renters have not gone through. I mean, another huge part of this issue is the laws that exist in Florida that allow eviction to be so fast-paced, that allow it to be so harsh. And so far, there does not seem interest in changing those. But on the local level, there are things that counties and cities can do. They could make these rental assistance programs permanent. They could pilot things like right to counsel laws. They could set up mediation programs. They could find ways to discourage landlords from just doing evictions and finding a different way to resolve the issue. Because even if a tenant wins their case, there's still an eviction on their record.
I think one other thing to remember here too is that for the people who already have an eviction on their record and they are lucky enough to find a landlord who will take them in despite that eviction, the quality of housing that you have access to once you've had an eviction on your record drops dramatically. So one of the families, the mother that is featured in my story, Bathsheba Collingwood, who lives on Mercy Drive, the apartment that she's trying so hard to save has had mold issues since the day she moved in. And if she and all three of her children take a shower back to back, her closet floods. And it's been that way since she's moved in. And a part of the reason that so many people were kicked out, and she's watched dozens of her neighbors get evicted. I believe she told me that 7 of the 40 other people who live there when she moved in, only 7 of them are still there now, just a year later. They all banded together to try to speak up. They called code enforcement and reported the problems to the city. And in response, their landlord evicted them all. And I think that the problem here is that, like Caroline said, because our laws in Florida are so landlord focused, renters have so few rights and so few protections keeping them in housing at all if they've had an eviction, and in housing that is safe and clean and livable as well. So this is a problem with many, many sides. And the legislature this session had a chance to do something about it, and they chose not to.
To both of your points, I mean, housing is an issue that we've been reporting on for a long time, it seems, in Central Florida. And the pandemic has really laid some of those problems bare in a pretty big way. We've been speaking with Desiree Stennett. She's a senior reporter who writes about race and equality in Florida, and Caroline Glenn, business reporter covering workers, housing, and economic injustice. We've been talking about their series, Locked Out, about evictions during the pandemic. Caroline and Desiree, thank you both very much for your reporting. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, Opera Orlando's performance of As One shines a light on the trans experience at a time when the rights of transgender Americans are also under the national spotlight. That's when Intersection returns.